I had just started dating my husband, now husband, and we were 21. And he then, you go for your follow-up, and he just spoke about his findings. And my husband, Jonathan, came with me, and he said, he's an older guy, and he was like, and, you know, we recommend that if you'd like to start trying for children, you should try sooner rather than later. And I couldn't even look sideways because I was thinking, thank you very much, doctor. Like, I really like this guy. And we're 21 and you're telling us to start having children. And I remember the car, and he didn't even kind of flinch. And then the car ride home, I was like, wow, do you like kids?
Hello and welcome to this In Conversation episode of Shameless with the formidable Kylie Brown. Kylie is in the public eye partly because her husband Jonathan Brown is a well-known former AFL star and radio personality, but it's what Kylie has managed to do with her profile and platform that has blown us away. After struggling with chronic endometriosis for 2 decades and undergoing no less than 9 surgeries, including a hysterectomy at 34 to manage her condition, Kylie opened an Instagram account, EndoRunner, to track her journey and spread awareness about endo. In this chat, we talk about Kylie's battle with her body so far and why she decided to run a marathon when the odds were well and truly stacked against her. Kylie was candid and generous, and we are so grateful for her insights in this episode, and we're absolutely certain that what she has to say will make so many of you feel less alone. Just a quick trigger warning as well before we jump into this one. This episode does deal with issues pertaining to pregnancy loss, miscarriage, and postnatal depression, and may be triggering for some listeners. Here's Kylie. Kylie Brown, welcome to Shameless In Conversation. This is the first in-person In Conversation we've done since March, and I actually don't know where to look right now. I feel a bit awkward.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. No, it's exciting.
We always start every interview with the same question, and that is, what were you like as a kid?
Oh, I would say sporty. My mum, I would say a bit shy, but then my mum used to say that every time I opened the fridge door and the light would come on, I'd start dancing. That was how she described me. My school reports would always be like about my, you know, schoolwork, blah, 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 but Kylie often gets distracted in class and distracts others. So I don't know, love a chat, and that'd probably be a good summary.
When you were a teenager and you started getting your periods, was there a point when you realised that your period pain was maybe different to the people around you, or that it was really starting to be quite paralysing?
I think from the very get-go, I knew, as people think, it's, you know, you only know what you've got, and I don't think it was really spoken about much, and I was quite late. I was 15, so I was quite late getting my periods. So I think when the conversations were happening, my friends were sort of more 12, 13. Mm. So it was kind of past that point of conversation. Yeah. But I didn't think it was normal because I would have to use like pretty much like maternity pads, and I would have to change during the night and wrap myself in a towel and would be really depleted from every period, anemic, all those things. Often couldn't go to school, or I'd have to come home from school because it was so heavy, which I hated because, you know, a sport day if I missed out on or whatever. So, and pain-wise, again, I just thought that was normal.
It's so hard. I mean, in high school, I feel like everyone always talks about period pain, and so it would be really difficult to figure out, okay, what's normal period pain and what's not normal, right?
Yeah, it's that whole, like, suck it up. Yes, you get a period and nap, you know, take Naprogesic. And I'm like, that doesn't, like, it did nothing for me. It just never really took the edge off. So the only thing that ever worked was a heat pack and rest, because it wasn't just pain and how heavy it was the exhaustion as well that would then kind of go on for a couple of days after.
So what was the point where you thought, I'm going to go to doctors and actually get this sorted out? I mean, I know you got your diagnosis at 21, but before that, was there a lot of talking to doctors and talking to people being like, can somebody please help me with this?
No, I never, I just, again, I just thought I had, that was my life and that was how they were and that's what I had to deal with. So I was 21 and I had had, I think went to do a smear and found out that I had some abnormal bleeding and some cells that didn't look right. So then I was referred to a gynecologist. And at that point, you know, I said to the doctor, the GP, I was like, well, what could this be? Because you know how they talk in code. Mm. And then at one point he was, you know, he went through everything and he said up to like cervical cancer. And I was like, wow, this is intense. Like then I just was very lucky that the surgeon and the gynecologist I was referred to ran the Research Institute for Queensland Endometriosis because 5 minutes. Like I was in with him for 5 minutes and he was like, this is wrong, this is wrong. And I'm 99% sure you have endometriosis. And I was like, I have what? Then even after the surgery, I had just started dating my husband, now husband, and we were 21. And he then, you go for your follow-up. And he just spoke about his findings. And my husband, Jonathan, came with me and he said, he's an older guy. And he was like, and, you know, we recommend that if you'd like to start trying for children, you should try sooner rather than later. And I just remember staring at the doctor and I couldn't even look sideways because I was thinking, thank you very much, doctor. Like, I really like this guy. We've been dating for three months.
3 months.
And we're 21 and you're telling us to start having children. And I remember and he didn't even kind of flinch. And then the car ride home, I was like, oh, that's weird. You know, like, wow, do you like kids? Like, but so, yeah, I was just lucky that it wasn't something that scared him off. But yeah, it was pretty confronting at 21 years old to be told that.
So is that something that you guys legitimately had to talk about then? That you get home, you're 21, you actually have to have that conversation. Okay, do we see kids in our future? Do we see each other in our future? And like, what's the timeline?
Yeah, well, I knew he's from a really big family. So I knew he wanted children because we'd sort of spoken about that. But we also didn't want to just rush into it for the sake of it. We kind of had a conversation, I guess, that 21-year-olds have. And then it was just managing symptoms and managing it. And it wasn't something that I wanted to then just do because it was forced. And I just sort of had to think, well, if it's meant to be, it will happen and I'm not going to just go and try for a baby at 21 because, you know, although, but it's scary because you think, you know, do you start freezing eggs? But we were just lucky that the course and the management that I was under was fortunate for us to be able to have children.
What did fear and stress look like being told that at 21? Because I think one of the forgotten conversations in, you know, the conversation about endometriosis and other kind of conditions similar is this sense that young women are being told that, you know what, a certain amount of women with this condition will struggle to have babies, but we don't know if it's you yet and off you go, good luck.
Yes.
And personally, I've always found that a very difficult thing because I'm like, well, I've got no information to go off. I have no idea what I'm meant to do.
No.
How did you process any of it?
I think it was more, I just was like, no, I will have children. And I just had to at that point, and I know a positive mindset is not going to change if things are, you know, medically that's what it is. I just literally had to just be like, you know, one day I will have children and I will do whatever I can and whatever it takes. But the fear is, okay, we get to that point and I can't. We'll, you know, Jonathan and I stay together because I know fam, and we had that hard discussion before we were married. And, you know, I did say to him, like, I know that children is something you really, really want. Like, he wanted four. So where does that? But he was always like, nope, we'll be fine, we'll be fine. But, you know, some people aren't fine.
Yeah.
And it is a lot of stress on relationships. And it's also, I would understand if people walk away because if that's what they want and sometimes love isn't enough and then does it put that pressure on the relationship? So everyone's so different and we're just very lucky that we didn't have to come across that.
It sounds like you two have a pretty incredible relationship to not be frazzled or flustered at 21 and then to not have that rock your relationship either in the lead up to marriage and thinking, no, we're just going to figure it out. Sounds like you guys have a really solid connection together.
Yeah, well, we so I had two or three operations, I'm trying to think, before we got married. And then I went in because I had some bad flare-ups and I knew that we wanted to start trying the minute we were married. And I remember going to this new gynecologist because my dear man had retired and he was quite abrupt and he's like, nope, you need another surgery, da, da, da. And this was 3 months before the wedding. You know, you won't fall pregnant and if you do, da, da. And I ended up not then sticking with him. But that was quite confronting too. So, like you said, that relationship and that strength you have to build because it's something you have to talk about.
How did endo infiltrate your day-to-day past the point of being a teenager? Like you're in your mid-20s and you've had a couple of surgeries. What did the pain look like day-to-day and how did it impact day-to-day?
I think the worst thing about endo pain is it comes out of nowhere and I think you can probably agree with that. So you might be having fun. Like I might have 2 weeks and I'll be like, nah, no issues. And then bang, it's like comes on and some people would almost look and be like, but you were fine yesterday. Like an hour ago you were fine. Like how are you now in bed? Or, and I tried very hard to, and I still don't let it take over my life. So that's why certain things I'm like, nope, you can be going somewhere else because I have stuff to do. So day to day, it is probably that, oh God, will I have a flare up? Or foods, like foods is really frustrating for me because I did have quite a lot on my bowel. So going out to a restaurant, I go through the menu and I'm like, oh no, that'll be bad, that'll be bad. Like I'll have to leave the table. So my diet is very, very basic. And I feel like that fussy, picky eater, like, no, I'm pesky, you know, and just making up all these different things, but it's not, it's real.
I want to talk to you about anger and frustration too, because I think having endo and vaginismus myself, I think one thing I'd never really heard anyone say was how angry they were at their own body or how angry they were that their mind often didn't cooperate with their body. Mm-hmm. And that sense of like consistent frustration that you're like banging your head against the wall, being like, I can never really understand what my body is doing. Like you can never really properly understand what's happening inside. Did you feel any of that, like anger and frustration and that head banging against the wall?
I did, because once I started to sort of realize, because I was lucky, so I had my surgeries and then between, but I don't know if I was told that having children will fix it.
Yeah.
So that was back when I was diagnosed. So I'm nearly 40. So that's 11 years ago. But I was always told that, you know, once you fall pregnant, it should almost clear out. And my endo was worse after children. But then other people are like, no, God, it's so much better. Mm. Once I started to then do research, so it was about anti-inflammatory diets, you know, exercise and anything that I could do to try and control it growing back and the rate at which it grew back, which we really don't have anything. All we can do is research and try things. Mm.
Did you ever feel anger at the medical professionals who were telling you things that didn't eventuate or telling you really harmful things like, no, you need surgery now right before your wedding? I imagine, sounds to me like anyway, just speaking already, you've had some doctors who are incredible and really helpful.
Yes.
And others who really hindered your ability to cope with the illness. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I was lucky, like I said, so the first surgeon ran the research. He was incredible. Quick diagnosis, bang, it's not in your head, like, which is a lot of what women hear. Second was the one I was like, he's not for me. So I moved on. But some women can't do that and they don't know because they're looking at the professional. So that is who they are guided by. So then they feel let down by that. Yeah. Second surgeon who actually operated on me was, he delivered my last baby and then he was unbelievable. Mm. And then my recent one, Katarina Ang, who's here in Melbourne, she was, again, unbelievable. So when it comes to that, I have been very lucky. Like my surgeon who did a lot of my surgeries and he performed my hysterectomy, he was on the Gold Coast and even while I was in Melbourne, I would Facebook him and tell him I'm coming up, things have flared up, and he would just straight away, okay, call the rooms, I'm operating on this day. Wow. So I'd go up on my holidays and it wasn't a great holiday, but I didn't trust anyone else at that point.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to say, symptoms. And then what we'd do is just before I'd go under, he'd be like, right, tell me the spots you're feeling it. Tell me where it is. And I would, it's almost like you're getting a laser level. And I'd be like, here, here, here. I reckon there's some on my bladder, some on my bowel, and a little bit, you know, to the left of here. And I'd wake up and once I was came to properly, I'd be like, okay, where was it? And he's like, you know your body too well. Like every single spot. And it was good for him because then he knew where to look for it. But I think that my frustration is more for the stories and all the stories I've been emailed and direct messaged about being misunderstood and pushed away. So I get frustrated because I have one experience, but these are people who are having it for 10, 15 years. And my frustration is for them that they're misunderstood.
For sure. I want to ask you about your first pregnancy because I imagine with most people that fall pregnant with their first pregnancy, they're euphoric. But with you, it must have been a sense of relief too. Like this is the thing that we both wanted. We wanted to have a baby. Did you feel that initial sense of relief?
So my first was a miscarriage and that I sort of didn't know I was pregnant, but then I miscarried in the shower and then I went and had the test. And
so you found out you're pregnant after you miscarried?
Yeah, it was. Wow. I was like, wow, this period is wild and has come on really quick. And there was lots of clots and I was just standing in the shower and I was like, like I've had some wild periods, but this is something else. And then the blood test result came back that it was that I was pregnant and that it was going down. And then when I fell pregnant with Olivia, I was excited, but it was, I don't know, I think you just you have to wait. So you have to wait for the 12 weeks. So we just told very immediate family. So you wait for the 12 weeks and then even when you get that back, then you've got to wait for the 20 week because the 20 weeks checking all the organs and that's a really intense like 1 hour scan. So I felt like by the time I could get excited, well, clearly everyone's like, yeah, we know you're pregnant. But
we can see it.
Yeah, yeah, like we get it, you're pregnant. But by the I always held back. And then I never got that we on the stick, oh, my God, you know, and posting things. And like not that back then I think we only had Facebook, but even still I didn't really use it. But I never got that moment with my first. So then when I fell pregnant with my second, which ended up being an ectopic pregnancy, I was like, nope, I am going to celebrate this from the beginning and whatever's meant to be will be. And then I lost it and well, I had surgery and had to have it removed. But I thought, you know what, the people who I told were the people that I needed to support me anyway. Mm. Yeah, I just after that I was like, nope. If I have more babies, like I'm going to be excited from the get-go because otherwise when do you get excited?
It's an interesting thing, the 12-week rule, because it kind of treats pregnancies as only legitimate once they do hit that mark and it kind of makes miscarriage even more taboo because it's like, oh, well, don't tell anyone because if you lose it, then what happens then? It's like, well, is that the worst thing in the world that women would announce it early on and then have that support
exactly
early on too, right?
And I guess depends how people – what support and the level of the people that you tell as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, your best friends and your family are who you need there at that point. So that's when I was like, is it not considered viable until you're 12 weeks?
Yeah, and it's like, well, should we not talk about it then? It kind of reinforces that thing like, oh, don't talk about it.
That big hiding thing where I've done so many times over the past few years where my friends have been, you know, we've been out for lunch and they're like, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's so exciting. But, you know, I'm going to have mocktails. So then people would be buying them drinks and then I would have to drink them for them. So by the halfway through lunch, I'm like buckled in there. I'm taking one for the team here. I've had my babies. So
how was it, though, to go through that loss? Like I know that's a big gear shift, but to go through that multiple times, a miscarriage, then an ectopic pregnancy, how was that as both a couple as well? My parents experienced a lot of pregnancy loss when they were having their four kids and my sister was stillbirth before I was born. And I know when I speak to my mum and my dad, they're both affected hugely still to this day by those losses, but they experience it so differently. Like mum literally had to go and give birth to my sister Jennifer and dad felt helpless because he couldn't take any of it away from her. How did you and Jonathan feel about that?
Well, so I had, miscarriage Olivia, miscarriage ectopic. So I tried to be – so my surgeon, I knew something was wrong because I had a sore shoulder, which was weird. And I went and I tried to get it massaged out, but I just started feeling sick. And then when they went to the scan, they were talking to each other. The doctor, she called the doctor in, and my obstetrician had said, like, he put the scan on, he just went quiet. And I said, there's nothing there, is there? So I could see the shape, and I knew I'd already seen what an embryo looks like, and I knew it wasn't there. So then I was sent around to, like, the imaging and to do a proper scan, and there was a lot going on, but they were talking to each other, and then Jonathan was just holding my hand because he knew. And I was trying to be the strong one, like, you know, I know these things can happen. And with endo, it is, ectopic pregnancy is a huge risk because of, if you've had it on your fallopian tubes, it buckles the tube. So my doctor said to me, we either see if it passes, because they didn't know where it was. They knew there was a pregnancy, but they didn't know where it was. So we either see if it passes, I can give you a medication to make it pass quicker, or I can go in and have a look. But I didn't have the pain in my pelvis. It was my shoulders, and that was from internal bleeding. So I said, nah, like, my gut feel, and I've always been right with my body, and I said, no, I need you to go in, something's not right. And then, yeah, he could see, like, the tube was about to burst, and he just couldn't believe that I didn't have the pain. So initially I was joking, and then it so happened that the two nurses that admitted me were pregnant. And I know, and they were so apologetic, because they were then, they'd come in with it and they're like, oh, to see what I was in for. And I was like, no, it's so fine. Like, you know, when are you due? And I'm having that conversation. And I don't know, I tried to be so strong going in. And then when I woke up, anaesthetic brings out the truth in everybody. And I was bawling my eyes out at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was texting my husband, I need someone here now. I was texting my parents who were on the Gold Coast and we lived in Brisbane. And I was like, I can't do this. And then I started abusing nurses because I was saying it was too hot in there and this should be a hospital and where's the fucking air conditioning. And I started ripping my clothes off. And then they were like, okay, we're going to get you a private room. I was like, thank you. But I think that's when it all kind of came out, once you realize that it is actually there. I had that gut feeling something was wrong, but then being told you've lost a tube and I still wanted more children, I didn't know that you can ovulate on one side and it get taken up on the other. I didn't know any of that. So all I knew was, is this now 50% chance that's been cut again?
Yeah.
Like, I'm already against the odds. Has this now lowered my chances? Yeah, it was really, really difficult. But again, I'm glad that I told my friends I told, because they were all around me and that was what got me through.
One thing I didn't know about your story was, before we were kind of doing some more research, was I saw a blog post that you wrote in 2015 for Beyond Blue about experiencing postnatal depression after having Olivia. And you wrote at the time, during a bad attack, I would start by feeling off balance, then nauseous. My face would turn pale as a ghost and I would feel really anxious and hold on to things as I walked to ensure I didn't fall over, especially when carrying Olivia. Can you speak?
I've got goosebumps.
Yeah. It's a bit weird when someone reads your own quote, especially about something like that. But can you speak to that time for us?
I think, like you said before about getting excited, I really think a lot of the postnatal depression and post-traumatic stress kind of came from the fact of thinking I was never going to be able to, you know, having that doubt that I might never be able to have a baby. And then next minute I do, and I didn't get that overwhelming bubble of love that everyone had spoken about. So it was almost like all my life, it's all I wanted, and then I've got it, and I was just having these horrific episodes. So, yeah, it was like that. And when you Google, because that's what you do at night in the middle, like, you know, Googling symptoms, and everything comes up as brain tumor, so don't Google. But I would be under my sheets at night and when I couldn't sleep, and I would be on my phone so that I'd be under the sheet so I didn't wake my husband. And I would be Googling all my symptoms, and it didn't ever come up as postnatal depression. Like, it never, being dizzy and off balance, and, you know, it, to me it was more like iron deficiency or an ear infection, you know, off balance. And the anxiety then came from that feeling of, you know, being unsteady and, as you said, holding her and being at home alone and thinking, am I going to pass out and I've got like a baby here with me? It was a really weird, weird like symptom that I went to multiple doctors, which you would have read, like I had so many tests done. And I remember going to this Chinese doctor and he said to me, the term beside yourself is literally that. So it is when you feel, when you are beside yourself, you are almost out of your body and not grounded and not within your body. So you are beside yourself. And I was like, I never thought of it like that. So then I would work a lot on grounding. And if I felt anything coming on, like out for dinner, because it would sort of turn into a bit of social anxiety because I didn't know what was going on. So I would often wiggle my toes in my shoes under the table, or I'd get up to go to the bathroom and push my feet into the ground to just sort of bring myself back into my body. And that helped quite a lot. But it was, yeah, it was terrifying. And it was 18 months till I was diagnosed.
I mean, looking back now as well, it makes so much sense that you had so much pressure on you, so much stress to do with falling pregnant, staying pregnant, giving birth. Like this had always been such a huge, colossal thing in your life that it really does feel like you were dealt one of the worst cards when it came to reproductive health. So it's not really surprising, is it, that you went through all this stress internally and that started manifesting?
Well, and it's really common. So I think a lot of women that go through IVF or any conception issues, it is like my doctor did say to me, you might need to speak to someone. And I was like, no, I'll be fine. Like, this is what I've always wanted. Mm-hmm. But it's almost that, you know, I think it's really common that anything to do with conception, you need to know that it's okay if you don't feel all that straight away. And it's quite normal because what you've always dreamed for and then you get it. And hormones are wild. Like, hormones do crazy things. So I always say to my girlfriends when I go up to meet the baby and go to the hospital, I always go to the mum first, hug her, tell her how amazing she is. Like, can you believe you grew a human? You are awesome. Because the baby's cute. The baby's always going to be cute. I mean, sometimes look a bit like an alien.
I was going to say not always cute.
Okay, wait, truth. Like, my son Jack literally looked like Benjamin Button. But everyone goes to the baby first. And my advice to anyone going to see a mum and the baby, go and tell her how amazing she is first, because baby doesn't know you're there. Like, cute, but because otherwise it's just that, you know, telling her she did a good job, because it's, you know, it's hard, and growing and giving birth or having a, like, however that baby comes out, it is tough, and what they have to go through. And normally, you know, you're sitting on the bed and you're in a huge pad and maybe sitting on a frozen condom because of your stitches, which was in my case, and people all coming in and you're thinking, and I had a catheter, and it's like, wow, this is just not cute, and people are all excited and you're trying to feel good. So it's like, go to the mum, tell her how amazing. That's great advice. Tell her how amazing she is.
Coming up after the break, the incredibly moving reason Kylie decided to start running. But first, a word from today's sponsor.
You obviously went on to have two other beautiful children. And then, as you mentioned before, at 34, you decided to have a hysterectomy.
Yes.
Talk to us about that decision, because I can't imagine it would have been easy. I mean, as young women, I feel like that word hysterectomy is incredibly overwhelming just as a word.
It's huge,
So Jack came very soon after the ectopic, and that was terrifying because I had the same symptoms and I was like, oh no, it's another ectopic. And then because of my troubles, and when Jack was one, or just before his first birthday, we started trying because we thought it may take, so they're only 20 months apart, 19 months apart. And then when Macy was only 6 months old, my symptoms started returning and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Yeah. So I went back to my gynecologist, and I had spoken, and I took my husband with me, and I was like, right, I'm done. I've done all I can do. It's happening again. I am grateful. I have three beautiful, healthy children, but now it's my turn to somewhat get some relief, and I just can't do this again.
Get your life back a bit.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, he's like, I really need you to think about it. And I'm like, I have thought about it, and I've been going through this since I was 15 years old, like this pain and knowing since I was 21. And he's like, you know, you're very young. And then we joked, because my last pregnancy was horrific and I started dilating when I was 25 weeks pregnant. And then I had to have all these, like, you put pessaries in every day, and I had to have steroid injections for her lungs, and all this stuff happened, and I whinged a lot, and I was crook. Like, I used to get so sick. And then I looked at both my obstetrician and my husband, and I was like, okay, do we really want, because she was only 6 months old, I'm like, do we really want me to be pregnant again? Like, do you guys, and they both looked and they were like, no, nope, okay, we get it. It was bad. So, again, I think the big thing with any endometriosis surgery is every woman, who, and again, who's reached out to me, doubts the severity of what they've got and doubts if it's actually there. So when I went under, the first thing I woke up and I, you know, once I came to again, I said to him, what would you have done if it was your choice? And he said, I had to take your womb. It was everywhere. It took him, he prides himself on being able to do a quick hysterectomy. And he's like, it took him 2.5 hours to get everything out. And it was going up to my, like, the kidney vessel. I couldn't really understand it, but he said it was really difficult, and yeah, it sort of had to, he couldn't untangle everything, it had to go. So that was that validation, which again, I knew, but just to hear that what you're feeling is not in your head is just a relief.
Yeah.
And every surgery I've had, the week before, a couple of days before, I go to pull out and be like, you know what, I don't want to waste a doctor's time. Like, there is people who are far more in need, and it's probably not there. Maybe it's just scar tissue pain. Maybe it's just nerves. You know, I've had it for a long time, so maybe it's just, it is a bit in my head, you know, that mind-body connection. Maybe, you know, shooting off that pain receptors, which they talk about a lot in pain management. You know, maybe that's what's happening. So maybe I need to just channel my body, concentrate on it healing itself, and I'm going to be fine. Like, the amount of times I've nearly called up to cancel because I doubt myself and my pain. And then, so that's why every time I wake up, I make them write on my hand, yes or no. If it's, so I've got photos on my page where, so I wake up because I'm always like, did it go back to the nurses? And then now they just like put my hand in front of my face and I'm like, I'm upset. But then I'm also like, no, I know my body.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, really good.
I can't imagine then how angry and frustrated you must have been, and to have had that hysterectomy, to have had all of these surgeries, and then to realize that not only is the pain back, but you're going to need to be, you know, operated on again. What was that like?
Well, so my surgeon didn't tell me, and I never asked. And I think, again, a lot of it is not buyer beware, but you know, that kind of not putting that negative.
Yeah, energy into the world.
Yep.
I don't even want to think about it.
And I didn't know. So I rang him and he didn't tell me and I didn't ask, and he never said it was a cure, but what was there needed to come out anyway. But he never, it's not like he, because people will be like, they gave you false information. No, it was, we didn't even want to think about that. We were just hoping that this would give me relief for, you know, as long as possible. I had moved to Melbourne at this point and it was only 12 months after my hysterectomy. And I was like, wow, that feels a lot like endo pain. And I was like, nah, can't be. And it was around ovulation and then a couple of other times. And then, you know, shooting pains up your bottom and shooting pains. And then the ones where it feels like you've been hit by a sniper rifle. And I was like, no, surely not. So I left a message with his reception and that he called me. And I said to him, is it common that after a hysterectomy, like, you get a lot of scar tissue pain or phantom pain? Because I don't have a uterus anymore. Like, I don't have a cervix. I still have my ovaries because they were at that stage, they were the only, which it's been on since, but they were the only thing that didn't have endo. And then he said to me, when are you here again? And I was like, actually, I'm coming up in a couple of weeks. And he said, come in and we'll have a chat. And then I started researching as well and realized that it could grow back. And I was like, fuck, like, what? And I think that one probably hit me one of the hardest, and it took me a really long time. And then I had to fly home with the kids and had to get a bit of help because my family were in Queensland, so I was here on my own. And yeah, that was really, really difficult. But as I said, there was never any misleading of saying it was a cure, but I just thought, if you don't have the parts,
Like, where does it go?
Yeah. So it was all pelvis, bladder, bowel, everywhere, like that it could find little spots, it was there. So that was, yeah, I was pissed off with that.
Kylie, what do you actually do? Do you scream? Do you cry? Like, I can't fathom hearing your story and how many times you've been on this yo-yo of just getting surgery, it coming back, getting surgery, getting a hysterectomy and it coming back. How do you let that anger out? I can't even imagine how much of a toll that would take on you internally to be like, what the fuck can I do now? Like, am I going to live with this for the rest of my life?
Yeah, which I am. So it's kind of, I cry. I'm a crier. Like, I love crying.
You're among cries.
Yeah.
Oh, we are big cries.
Like, I can't believe I actually haven't cried. Like, when you read out my quote, I was like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. I cry. Like, I find a lot, but I'm a happy crier as well. Mm-hmm. Like, when, you know, if you see someone greet someone at the airport.
Oh, yeah.
Which we haven't seen for a long time. But, like, I'll cry watching. I can cry watching ads. Like, I'm shocking with crying. So, tears. Like, I think tears really, more than anger, because I probably more feel helpless rather than angry, but then I have to turn it around and feel grateful, which it's sort of that vicious cycle of, you know, where do you, because then I look at people that don't have children and have been through this horrible and miscarriages and losses and what you're talking about. So I don't know, it's that point of being grateful, but then it's also, you know, there's always someone worse off and it doesn't make what you're going through any less stressful and upsetting. But yeah, it's probably more crying than screaming and yelling.
That's a tricky conversation, like pregnancy loss or struggling with these things after you have a child. I feel like it's something that lots of women feel like they can't talk about. I know my mum felt it when she had a stillborn baby after my older sister Claire, because she's like, well, where's the room for this conversation? Because I don't want to alienate the women who haven't been able to have children, but also my grief is still valid.
Absolutely.
Do you feel lost sometimes being like, where can I take this story? Because I don't want to offend people, but I also want to get this out and make people feel seen.
My husband, like Jonathan, often, which it's only been in the last sort of couple of surgeries, because I would just say to him, okay, I'm going to go see Manish again. He's like, why? Because I would hide it. Because to me, I'm like, it's boring chat.
Yeah.
Like, I've been through this for, it is, so, I'm in pain. Like, how boring? Like, move on. And I know it's valid. But it's a conversation that, again, if you give airtime to it, is it then that it takes over your life?
Yeah.
So I think that whole not talking about it is good and bad in a way, but not giving it airtime. But then I think it does need airtime. So for me, it's more about supporting and helping other people. And that's when I started my running page and the outpour of messages and the people that say, my parents don't know, or my friends don't know. And I'm like, what do you mean? So not that I talk about it all the time, but obviously my friends and family know, because and my kids know, because my son used to think I was just going to get extra belly buttons. Why do you have so many belly buttons? And I was like, oh God. And because they're so, and also the scars just do not justify that shit that you go through and the pain, like these tiny little, it's great, but the tiny little keyhole scars, it's like, oh wow, like, and you've got a little
keyhole surgery,
yeah, like just a little stitch there, like one stitch, it's like, wow, that is not what I went through. But the page, probably the thing that upset me the most was starting that page. It took off so fast, and the amount of women that connected just makes me so sad that it is everywhere. So, I mean, they say 1 in 10. I'm going to call bullshit on that. I reckon maybe 1 in 10 that are
properly diagnosed.
Exactly. I think I've got a group of, say, 10 friends. There's 6 of us that have severe endo. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, it's just everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the conversation is so important, especially if people don't feel like they can talk to their friends or family.
Talk to us about running. You just mentioned that page and it was a very well thought out answer for us to lead us into the question that I wanted to ask, which was, where did running come in all of this?
So, again, with pregnancy loss, well, not pregnancy loss, it was loss. My good friend Sally Crinis, oh God, I'm crying. she had a little girl and she was 99 days old.
and she passed away from a rare genetic heart condition. And having been through loss of a different kind and nothing like that, I mean, I just can't even imagine taking your healthy baby home, and because I didn't know. And then she was diagnosed 1 week later. She was, well, 2 weeks after that, she passed away. Like, it was that fast. So they knew nothing was wrong. And I just think of that moment when, you know, the baby's in the capsule and that photo when you're leaving the hospital that everyone does. And she was just so unbelievable and strong. And I just didn't know, like, how she was getting out of bed every day. And she has another little girl, Sophia. And anyway, so one of Sally's friends said, I'm going to run the Melbourne Marathon in honour of you and Lucia. And then bit by bit, that grew and became Lucia's Angels. And I signed up to do the 5K, and then I was like, no, come on, you can do a bit more. So I hadn't run. And so then I signed on to do the 10. And then Sally was going to, with her twin sister, Susie, they were going to do, I think at first she was just going to do the 5K walk because, one, she had just lost her daughter. Secondly, she was only, I think, about 5 months postnatal. So next minute she was like, stuff it. And she signed up to do the full marathon. And I was just absolutely in awe of her strength and just how she was literally getting out of bed every day, let alone training for a marathon. So that moment when they came into the MCG, we did a full guard of honour and we were all in pink. And it's on the Melbourne Marathon website and on Sally's Crinus's page. And I was just so touched by what she was able to achieve. And then even she was interviewed straight after and she spoke so, like, her message was so clear. And oh, she was just unbelievable. I just was in awe the whole time and I still am. And then we had drinks afterwards and then we had a lot of rosé and another friend got up to do a speech and then Sally spoke and Sally thanked everyone. And again, she's actually calling me.
Oh my God.
Her ears are burning.
Her ears are burning.
She's like, are you crying about me on a podcast? Yes or no?
Oh, that's wild.
That's amazing.
Yes, that's weird. But so she got up and she was like, right, we're going to do this every year now and Lucia's Angels is going to grow. And they end up raising like well over $300,000 for the Royal Children's Cardiology Ward. So yeah, we were at this after drinks and just the whole day I just felt like I was staring at her, just, you know, in awe. And then she's like, okay, so everyone goes up a category. So if you've done the 10, you're going to do the half. And if anyone wants to join us, you can do the full marathon. And I was probably two bottles of rosé deep. And I was like, I'm doing it. Like, I'm doing the full marathon. And I so did a couple of other people, not one person this year within that 300 have done anything. But I'm the type of person that if I commit to it, like, I'm doing it. So because she didn't end up running and then I found out just before that I had to have surgery and I spoke to Sally and I was like, Lucia will always be my inspiration. You will always be my inspiration, which is in a lot of the photos you might see gold wings, which were from her funeral. So they were on my hat. And it's actually really ironic, but my friend made me a logo, Endo Runner. And if you look at it, it actually looks like an L. It's an E, but it looks like an L. And it was just ironic, the pink and everything. So I just thought, if she can do it, I can do this. And it just gave me motivation.
But Kylie, you were recovering from your 9th endometriosis surgery in February this year. We're recording this in the first week of December. You ran the marathon not even a week ago, right?
Yes, Saturday just gone, yeah.
How do you pull your body into that?
I think I'm not going to make it any worse. Like, I've tried to do things to make it better and it's made it worse. So, you know, obviously I got medical clearance before I even started walking. I did do a couple of laps around the ward. But I did find that movement was key this time and it really, really helped with my recovery and helped with my mental state. I didn't want to sit in self-pity. As we said, this is a reality now. Like, this is my life and I am trying to think positive and think that that's my last and I'm putting that out to the universe, but it might not be. So I don't know, I've
ticked over day by day, and it was honestly the hardest thing I've ever done. Then we go into a pandemic where you're not even allowed, you know, I just hit 21Ks and then we got told we had to be inside and we could only exercise for 1 hour. Now I am not fast. So going from that.
You're also amongst friends in that category.
Oh my God. And I was like, how? And I remember I had a full meltdown then. And I said to my husband, like, I have worked my ass off to get to a half marathon. I am so close. And we have 1 hour. So we ended up buying a treadmill. So I would run for an hour outside and then I'd come inside and I'd finish off the rest. But that's a mind game as well. And I don't know, the motivation was, you know, always Sally, always. And then the messages I would receive, and the page was just such a beautiful place to go. Like my personal page, I don't know, has 50 something thousand followers. I hardly go on that. I go on this Endo Runner page and it fills me full of so much joy and positivity. And it is just a really, I think that even the whole Endo community is such a really beautiful, supportive space. So yeah, I think I honestly don't know how I did it looking back, but I was bloody determined.
More than 40 kilometres. How does 42. It feel?
42.2. 42.2.
0.2. How's it feel to cross the finish line?
So the first probably 25 was okay. And then I got to about 20. They say you hit a wall and I well and truly hit that wall. So about 28 Ks in, I was texting my husband saying I'm dying. And I had my niece, Shay, riding along behind me, giving me all my treats and my supplements and what I needed, because I had to have something every 5 kilometres because it's quite dangerous. Like going for that long, like your body is depleted. I was seeing spots. I was so dizzy. I literally thought I was going down and it was almost like the wind just, there was just no air. It was quite humid that day. And I was scared. Like I was scared that I wasn't going to finish this. And I was like, I think I'm going to die. Like this was the hardest thing. And I have birthed 3 children and my first birth was traumatic. And it was the hardest mental thing I have ever had to do because it is a long time. With 7Ks to go, also just I had 10K to go and then my 11-year-old daughter Olivia, my husband ran up with her and he's like, Liv wants to do the last 10 with you. And it was, he's like, now Liv, go and just don't talk, don't ask questions, just go with mum.
Don't annoy her.
Go. And we were probably about 2 minutes in. She's like, how far to go? And I was like, I can't even talk about that. And then I wish I had footage of this, but the GoPro died on the front of the bike. But she was rubbing my back and we were arm in arm for a bit. And having a daughter or having 2 daughters, it is one of my biggest fears. And it's another thing that I don't like to give light to, but the reality is I could pass it on. So that triggers me so much. And I think just the fact that she was there with me was such a huge drive to to get me through. And she just kept saying to me, you're doing so well. And then, yeah, she's rubbing me on my back and I'm thinking, and I kept checking on her and I'm like, Liv, it's really hot. Like this is a long, you've never done 10K, this is a long way. And she's like, no, mum, I'm okay. And then I'm passing her my water and checking on her. But she was just so, and I could feel the pride in her. And I think it was, you know, something that I almost, I felt like there was that piece that was meant to happen. It wasn't planned and it was meant to happen to get me through because, as I said, I'm running for future generations and she, unfortunately, with Macy, could be one of them. And crossing the finish line and then we sort of false started a bit and then I was like, no, put the ribbon down. I've still got more to go. So then we went up and then I said to Liv, let's bring it home. And we sprinted down the hill and then was wait just a bit further. Jack was waiting. So I grabbed his hand and then little Macy and we were flying at that point and her legs were going like a million miles an hour. And yeah, we all went through and we just got the most beautiful footage and lifting that ribbon up. I will never ever forget it because it's just something that, yeah, with 7Ks to go when I started crying And I didn't want her to know I was crying, but it was just so hard. And I think for the kids to see your mum, who's not an athlete, like their dad was an athlete, so he did a marathon, and that's kind of expected. But as you said, coming back from 9 surgeries, everything I've been through, I'm not a runner. I can say I am now, but pushing, there's something about pushing yourself to the limit and doing it for something bigger than yourself, which is research. And, you know, hopefully one day a cure is something pretty special and a moment I will never forget.
Feels like the theme of your story, at least of your 2020 between Olivia and Sally and the Endo Runner page, is like the sisterhood.
It really is. And I just think it's just been such a shitty year for everyone. And so many people have said to me, in such a bad year, I'm so glad, and I don't know how you've kept going, but you've given me motivation to get out and go for a walk, or you've given me motivation to start yoga, like whatever it is, to think, you know, you're still going amongst everything that's going on. And I had so many things thrown at me, like my knees went, my back, there was so many issues like with my feet. But I just refused to give up, and I feel like it's the one good thing that's come out of this horrible year. And I think that's what's kind of banded a lot of people together as well, because they've followed along from the beginning. I bawled when I did my first 5K, and my mum actually was at home, and I came in the door and I was like hyperventilating. She's like, oh my God, did you fall over? And I said, no, I just did 5 kilometres. And she was like, oh. And then she thought I was putting way too much pressure on myself. And yeah, I was like, no, it's just, it was that thing. That was what I could do before surgery. So to get to that point again was like, okay, tick this. I got a long way to go, but that 5K was really important.
Carly, the last question we ask everyone is for their definition of success. So I'm very intrigued with all of this in mind. What is success to you?
That's a really good question. I think success for me, like for me personally, just would be setting something, a realistic goal, and whatever that, like I said before, everyone has a different level, not comparing to other people's goals, not comparing to anything else, just finding something that is slightly out of reach or considered slightly out of reach and working your absolute butt off to get there. To get anywhere in life, there is going to be hurdles and there's going to be setbacks and there is going to be whatever it is, whether career, anything, you are going to get pushed down so many times. But it's when it's not about that. It's the getting up and the getting to it that's the most important.
Kylie, thank you so much. I am so grateful that you came on. I actually feel a bit teary because I think for a lot of people with endo, there's just a lot of shit that you go through. And I think seeing you be able to run how much you did is like insane. So thank you so much. I can't believe I'm crying. Genuinely, I am very, very grateful.
It's contagious.
It is. It's contagious crying. Because Michelle's crying too. But
I'm a sympathetic crier.
You have had an incredible year, and this has been an incredible first in-person interview back. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this In Conversation episode of Shameless with Kylie Brown. If you're wanting more from Kylie, go follow her on Instagram at endo.runner. If you enjoyed this chat, we also recommend you listen to our other In Conversation episode with fellow endo warrior Bridget Hustaway. We will pop the links to that chat in our show notes. As for us, the best way to support the show is click follow on Spotify or subscribe on Apple, or recommend this episode to a friend. Thank you so much, guys. We'll be back in your ears on Monday.